Happy Wednesday to you all. Thank you for tuning in. I'm on air until 3 o'clock. That is Ciara Noble here with Kildare Focus. Coming up in the next few moments, we will be speaking to the Ombudsman for Children's Office on their 2021 annual report. We'll also chat with the Irish Wheelchair Association. We heard yesterday outdoor dining is here to stay for the summer season, but the advocacy officer with the IWA says it's caused major hazards and better consultation is needed for those who are using wheelchairs. Danielle McLaughlin is the Policy and Communications Officer with Ruhama. Their annual report has been released also, and demand for sexual services persisted in 2021 despite the lockdowns and regulations due to COVID-19. And then we'll speak with Elaine Loughlin, Deputy Political Editor of the Irish Examiner. She had a really, really interesting piece in the Irish Examiner. It is available still online. Who do rural independent TDs really represent? We will hear from Elaine at about 2:45 this afternoon. And of course, I would love to hear from you. Let me know how you are today. The text and WhatsApp line 0833 97 97 97. We also have the studio phone. Dimpna's in there today. It's 045 901 490. And email studio@kfmradio.com.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Noble.
Now, we do have Nuala Ward, Director of Complaints and Investigations with the Ombudsman for Children's Office on the line this afternoon. We're going to be discussing the 2021 annual report, and one of the main findings of it, 79% increase in complaints to the Ombudsman for Children, with education issues dominating. It's Resilience Tested, the Ombudsman for Children's Office annual report is the full name, and Nuala is on the line. Good afternoon, Nuala.
Hello, Ciara. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us. Yourselves at the office, were you surprised by a near 80% increase in the number of complaints last year?
I think after the year we went through, I'm not sure we get too surprised about anything anymore. The complaints were, you're right, it's the highest number of complaints the office has ever received since it opened in 2014. But it does reflect the unpredictable year we had. And of the over 2,000 complaints, over approximately 900 of them were in matters related to COVID. So a lot of people contacted the office because they had a range of concerns about school closures, face masks on children. So that it does explain the big increase that we've had from 2021.
Yeah, and if we look across the country, you can see in Kildare, I believe the increase was about 2%. If we look at our neighbours in Dublin, 37% increase, quite an increase there in that county. You mentioned the identified complaint trends for 2021 was, you know, majorly due to COVID. But SNAs, special need assistance allocations, was something that came up regularly. The lack of provision for ASD places and units in schools, bullying, cyber attack, and the Leaving Cert 2021. So if we touch on bullying a little bit there, Nuala.
Yes, of course. Bullying is a real concern for our office. It was 10% of our complaints this year in relation to schools, and that figure has been consistent for the last few years. We hear firsthand exactly the impact that bullying has on children, on families, and on the school community, and it's an area that causes grave concern. What we do welcome is that the department, you may be aware, the Department of Education has created a steering committee to create a new action plan to address bullying in schools, and we are going to be active participants in it because we want to make sure that it's child focused and informed by children's rights, because it's such a serious issue for children.
The main complaints, obviously, related to COVID-19, the restrictions in school. The office was contacted in relation to the cold classrooms. That was something that was the top of many parents' worries, because the windows were left open for ventilation reasons. And those who contacted yourself at the office felt these measures were disproportionate and unfair on the children, as they remained in place after the pubs opened and the adults could mix and socialise with very little restriction in place. And that was a general theme that, you know, was seen throughout the pandemic. The balance at times was not there across the board in terms of society as a whole.
Yeah, that's what we, I mean, I think it's really important that while we're not a public health advisory body, we are a children's rights institution, and our advice throughout the pandemic in relation to the restrictions were to ensure that when they related to children, they were proportionate, reasonable, and for the minimum time possible. So that's really important, and it's a message we always say to the government, no matter what minister we meet, is this necessary? How long are you going to do it for? And it's proportionate to the risks. So you're right, it is, it's been a very, very difficult time for children, and part of our message from the annual report is that we must invest in our children now, into communities, into sports clubs, into our health services, just to try and kind of mitigate what happened to children over the last couple of years.
Separated parents. The office received contacts from separated parents who encountered difficulties maintaining visits and access with their children who didn't live with them. Obviously, the government imposed travel and distance restrictions, as well as the guidance on the non-mixing of households, was the main barrier there, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So it was all right, but we were also, it's really important that when decisions like this were being made, and of course we all know this pandemic and decisions were made in a crisis and we had to prioritise survival, it was about also considering the best interests of the children. So that's, if you remember correctly, then they started creating the concept of bubbles, so that even if you was a non-related member, if you, because sometimes we had people contacting us because they were caring for, you know, a child that might be in a different household, or I'm sure there's others who are caring for elderly parents, so that they were able to become part of their household. So that, again, was a really important decision to make for everybody.
Throughout the pandemic, the station did speak to two parents in particular of who are carers of their children. And that was one of the main complaints to do with COVID-19 that the office did receive. The forgotten families, it's referred to here. And it's circumstances where healthy children live with very high risk, medically vulnerable parents, caregivers or family members.
Yeah, that was very difficult. It is very, very difficult. It was so, just when we met with some of those families and, of course, with the children, we got some very emotive, there's very powerful letters for us to read from children and saying what it was like, fear of bringing something back to their household. So that was something, again, we worked really hard and we strongly, and Dr. Niall Muldoon did strongly advocate on behalf of these children, because one size does not fit all with government policy. And I really hope that's something that we're going to carry on into the future. You have to be able to make sure that there's always going to be outliers. There's always going to be someone that won't fit into that particular box. And we need to make sure that any decision is child-centred and flexible. We have to be flexible because, as you know, we're all different. So that was a really, that was a very difficult time for those children.
There's a range of complaints here, and if you look at the breakdown by category of the complaints to the office, it notes the education complaints. This is in 2020, obviously, the beginning of the pandemic. 2020 was declared 46%. In 2021, 53%. Health complaints in 2020, 14%. In 2021, increased by 3% to 17%. Local authority complaints at 6%. In 2021, that actually decreased to 5%. Justice complaints at 5% in 2020, 1% in 2021. Finance, social protection and welfare complaints in 2020 was at 2%, 2021 at 1%. Family support, care and protection complaints, 20% in 2020, 12% in 2021. And then other complaints is how it's categorised here, 7% in 2020 and 12% in 2021. Nuala, because the range is so wide, the question I'm asking is going to be very difficult, I understand, for you to pinpoint. But what are the main takings for the office after this annual report of 2021, when it was the full 12 months in the pandemic?
The main taking from the office in relation to COVID, I suppose what we really felt, and Niall, I think the Ombudsman yesterday spoke really strongly and passionately about the need for us to recognise how resilient our children have been, how much they've had to take on and how much they missed out on, and events that we can't give them back. We can't give them back the confirmation that they missed. We can't give them back their debs. We can't give them back maybe the All-Ireland, the football final that they were going to play in. And that is really very hard for children. We got to remember that they went through a very very, very difficult time. So again, I think what we want to see is a big recognition and a big push from the government to invest in our children's future, to recognise their resilience and just to try and protect it as they move forward, because we cannot leave what we've learned behind us. You know, sometimes we can have very short memories. We can't do it. We just can't do it. Not now. Us as the adults, we have a responsibility towards these children over the last few years. And so we hope we'll see that in the future and reflected in government decisions going forward.
Nuala Ward, thank you for joining me. You're, of course, Director of Complaints and Investigation with the Ombudsman for Children's Office. I appreciate your time this afternoon. And just before I go to a piece of music, I'm going to break down the complaints by county. So if we look at us here in Kildare first, in 2021, we know as a total for the 26 counties, 2,126 complaints were made. So in Kildare, it did have 2% of the complaints, and it is 42 complaints in the county in 2021 out of the 2,126 that was nationally. If we look at our neighbours in Carlow, 21 complaints made there. If we go down to Laois, it is 42 complaints, the same number as Kildare. And if we look at our neighbours in Wicklow, 43 complaints, just one more than County Kildare. Offaly, 21 complaints. Meath, 43 complaints, again, just one more than Kildare. And if you look at Dublin, obviously the highest number of complaints, that's 787 out of the total 2,126 complaints. You may have heard yesterday, outdoor dining is here to stay for the summer season. The government has approved plans to extend the COVID-19 measure, that's for pubs and restaurants, for another 6 months. So it was introduced last July. The temporary laws were brought in to allow the pubs and restaurants serve alcohol on the street. That's in designated seating areas. It was to expire on the 31st of May, but it's set now to be extended until the end of November. People like Adrian Cummins from the Restaurants Association of Ireland have said it's something they've been campaigning for, but Joan Carthy, who is my next guest, is the advocacy officer with the Irish Wheelchair Association. And she says it's caused major hazards and better consultation is needed. Thank you for taking the time this afternoon to speak with me, Joan.
Good afternoon, Ciara. Thank you.
We can all, I guess, have compassion to some degree with the owners and the restaurant owners and the publicans of this country. COVID-19 was absolutely and did absolutely have a massive impact on their businesses. But not much, I guess, media attention was given to those who are affected by things like the extension of the outdoor dining. And it's only when we're alerted to these things can we understand them. Joan, just speak about from, you know, your own experience and people you've been speaking with, how they have found the extension and the impact on their daily lives.
Yeah, no problem. And I suppose just really to start off, we completely understand where the restaurants and bars are, you know, are coming from with the outside dining. They absolutely have to try and recoup the money lost. And it was so difficult for them during COVID, without a doubt. But a lot of the problems, I suppose, really is in the planning. The legislation was brought in as emergency legislation, which left very little time to get things right. And that's where the problems began. There was a lot of restaurants and bars allowed to have outdoor dining, but there wasn't enough space left for people with disabilities to be able to navigate the towns and cities safely. Whether you had a visual impairment or you were a wheelchair user, there was restrictions trying to navigate places where you were used to being able to navigate.
Now, Richard Guiney is from Dublin Town, and there's a report here saying that he said outdoor dining creates a better ambiance and enhances perceptions of safety, but he has said regulation is needed. You have said there needs to be further consultation or better consultation. What do you mean exactly by that? Go into the detail there, Joan.
Well, the detail of it is really talking to people with disabilities, finding out what the issues are, but actually looking at what accessibility standards are. I mean, they're out there, and the councils really need to take into account that when they're looking at space that's needed for outdoor dining, what's happening is they're working at the absolute minimum measures. And when that is the ideal and when that's what's in place, what happens is when people sit in the chairs and the tables and they move them back, they move them out, you're actually straight away moving into the walkway. So there has to be very specific designated areas for outside dining where they're, I suppose, they're segregated, and whether that's by, and I think people spoke about it before, you know, kind of strong wind sheeters or whatever, so that you're not encroaching, you know, or even accidentally encroaching on the walkways. But a lot of our cities and towns are very old, so they're not built in a way to necessarily enable outside dining. So right. A lot of our streets, our paths are quite narrow, and that in itself causes an issue.
If you were to say something to, would say, the restaurants and pubs in general, like, they're going to get the extension for the outdoor dining and they have, mm-hmm. you know, the dining areas. There are other things possibly that businesses can do to, obviously, we want, as the Justice Minister said, you know, we want these businesses to thrive. It's been a really difficult time. We understand the importance for the Irish economy of these businesses. And you mentioned that at the beginning of the interview. But there are little steps that they could take. I know before I've heard you mention things like, you know, the sandwich boards maybe could be moved and more mm-hmm. simple things that businesses never think of because they aren't dealing with the same issues that yourself or others who are members of the Irish Wheelchair Association are.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose even without the outside dining, there is always an issue of street clutter. So it's really important for businesses to kind of be mindful and to think about what they're placing outside their business to make sure there is that space. But I will go back to that point that some of our pathways are just not built to accommodate outside dining and to also accommodate pedestrians being able to go up and down. So if you're an able-bodied person and you're walking and visually everything is okay, you may be able to step out onto the road and get back up the other side with maybe little inconvenience. But this sort of thing actually impacts on a lot of other people besides people with disabilities. So you're talking about parents with buggies and elderly people. So it's not just a call from, I suppose, people with disabilities. It's really a call from the general public to be able to be very mindful of what is being put out on our footpaths and the impact that is having. I know, as you said earlier on, it does give, I suppose, a safeness to our cities when you have more people on the roads and that. But as a person just trying to navigate our towns and cities as a wheelchair user personally and from people that I'm talking about, it just becomes impossible. And what's happening is people are becoming more isolated. People with disabilities are becoming more isolated because they can't get around the way they used to.
It's always great to highlight things like this. I actually spoke myself, Joan, last week. I noted somebody was walking alongside somebody who was using a wheelchair and there was a small branch in their way. Just a small one, not a massive one. And they naturally just moved it out of their way, even though it wasn't in the way of the person using the wheelchair. But they obviously had that thought process to know that potentially somebody could come across this and it could cause an issue or a problem or an accident. And as you say, it's about us as a whole society being more mindful, and highlighting things like this hopefully will help all of our listeners here in Kildare and the wider area to understand how we can make a difference. Outdoor dining is here to stay for the summer season, but as the Irish Wheelchair Association has said, it is causing major hazards and better consultation is needed, but they do obviously see the point and the benefit for the pubs and restaurants who will have really struggled over the past 2 years. Advocacy Officer with the Irish Wheelchair Association, Joan Carthy, thank you so much. So according to Ruhama, the organisation that fights sexual exploitation, prostitution and human trafficking, despite the pandemic last year, the demand for sexual services persisted, creating massive threats, it's worded here, to vulnerable women. So its annual report was published today and Ruhama engaged with 369 women over the year. That's an increase of 21.5% from 2020. 136 of those women were victims of human trafficking for the purpose of sexual exploitation. And Danielle McLaughlin, the Policy and Communications Officer with Ruhama, joins me. Hi, Danielle.
Hello, Ciara.
Thank you very much for joining me. We know your chief executive, Barbara Condon, did say today that Ruhama was deemed an essential service in 2020. The report obviously talks about accounts of individual women with who Ruhama works with. One Romanian service user, it says here, described how the man who controls her every day keeps her compliant. She's quoted here, "If I do anything wrong, he threatens to beat me. Even worse, he says that he will tell his mother, in whose care I left my daughter, to bring my daughter to the orphanage and leave her there. That she would be better off without me, that I am a bad mother. That terrifies me, so I am still here. I think that is what is heard a lot. I am still here because of certain reasons." And obviously that has been brought forward to Ruhama over the past year.
Absolutely. I mean, that case that is in our annual report today is one of the many cases that we've heard. It sounds very extreme, but actually it is quite common to hear in Ruhama. And our experience over the last 30 years working with women directly impacted by prostitution, sexual exploitation and sex trafficking, most women coming through to the service do want help, do want to escape, feel trapped and are driven through many different ways into prostitution or trafficking through coercion perhaps, being lied to that there is a job in Ireland for them, and they arrive and they're told passports taken off them, they're told that they need to work to pay off their debt, and the woman is eventually trapped. Like this woman in our report today, Iona, this is an example of how extreme it can get for women and how they are really trapped and they're trying to get out of it. And in the next case study that we have in the report, the woman eventually fled and made a run for it. So, I mean, and that's another story as well with the woman who's been trafficked. And there are many different ways. There's threats made to family. They're told that their children will eventually come and join them afterwards.
That is horrific. That is absolutely horrific.
Yeah, and they're experiencing regular violence. They are told that, you know, their passport's been held. They can get kicked out of the country. They feel they've no options. I mean, and then that's in, you know, particular case we're talking about, the majority of the women who access our services are migrant women from various countries all over the world, but there is a proportion of Irish women who feel from very different backgrounds and various backgrounds who feel compelled to sell sex because to get them out of debt. There are addiction issues, there are childhood trauma and sexual abuse. There are many drivers into prostitution and sex trafficking, and this is the type of this is what we want to highlight to the public and get people to be aware of it, and if they see signs of it, to really be informed and be able to identify where people might be trapped in something like that, and we'll need your help to contact the Gardaí. The Gardaí work with us very closely, and there's a national referral mechanism that is used as a formal referral through the guards, and then there's further supports in terms of accommodation, in terms of financial support, in terms of regularising their immigration status. There are a lot of supports there. And interestingly, from the perspective of the Midlands in particular, our service expanded last year and recruited a Midlands caseworker, an outreach caseworker.
So let me just stop you there for one second, Danielle. Does that mean that the prevalence of women experiencing, would say, abuse, of course, of control, etc., has increased in the Midlands region, or it has stayed maybe the same, but just now Ruhama is being able to get out, people get or extend their services in the area?
It's hard to say what's increased, but we definitely have a need. There are women from every county in Ireland seeking the services of Ruhama. So our intention and our hope is to expand, and we have plans in place at the moment that will be extended further towards Limerick. And the current Midlands outreach officer is working for women in several counties in the Midlands. So there's an ongoing need, and unfortunately people trapped in the system and the sex trade are they're being moved around. Women who are being handled or, you know, being managed by sex traffickers are moving people around to different counties, to different, you know, the renting apartments. A lot of people wouldn't know this, and these are the kind of signs that we're trying to highlight, that it's happening. It's happening in each and every county in Ireland. It could be happening next door. This is a reality. Women do not want to be there. They don't want to sell sex. They want an escape. And in our experience, women who are seeking support from Rahama want to leave, and many are supported, and many are successfully exit the sex trade and move on towards independence. Financial independence.
Your chair, Ian Carter, is quoted as saying, "We need frontline workers to understand that trafficking isn't a social concept, but rather a day-to-day reality they may encounter in their work." One of the good things about the annual report that has been highlighted here, Danielle, is that the ongoing development of the expansion of Rahama's counselling and trauma therapy service, it was a key strategic priority for 2021. 69 service users did access the service. That was an increase of 68% from 2020, and a reported decrease in anxiety, depression, and a reduction in the risk of suicide was noted in the annual report. So that is a positive to take from it.
It is a positive. I mean, it is really highlighting the damage and how harmful the sex trade is to women. In our experience, there are numerous negative impacts on women: their liberty, their physical and mental well-being, their body autonomy, sexuality, all of these things women experience. And often it's the case that women who are seeking support from our caseworkers around many practical kind of matters and in some emotional support will be referred into trauma therapy and counselling, because this trauma then starts to kick in once they have moved out or they've exited prostitution. And then we know this from PTSD, that it often happens much later after the trauma has occurred. So women do need that support. They need a breathing space. They need time to recover, because they are recovering from trauma. And it is harmful in many ways. So this support service is huge. It's been a huge positive service for us to be able to provide, and we hope to expand on that as well.
We appreciate your time this afternoon. That is Policy and Communications Officer with Rahama, Danielle McLaughlin, on their 2021 annual report, The Demand for Sexual Services Persisted in 2021. So Elaine Loughlin joins me now. She's the Deputy Political Editor of the Irish Examiner. Good afternoon to you, Elaine.
Good afternoon.
Very interesting article you had yesterday. I'm going to read a couple of the lines you've said here. It seems members of the rural independents are for poor people when they burn turf, but against them when they go out to work. One by one, Michael Healy-Ray and his fellow rural independent men stood up last week in the Dáil to poke holes at a bill to provide our working poor with a living wage. Yes, so Elaine, you ask, which is it, support the poor or support the poor when it suits them? You go into a lot of detail here about the different independent TDs who have made comments on several issues we have in the country currently, major issues. The living wage was one of them, and you noted it sets down an evidence-based rate of pay that is deemed adequate income to give people a socially acceptable minimum standard of living. Currently, the minimum wage is €10.50 in this country, but the living wage has been set at €12.90. What did these independent TDs say about that?
Yes, well, as you said, the living wage is something that practically every party in the Dáil now does support, and this bill was brought forward by the Labour Party. The living wage is slightly different to what we have in place at the moment. That's the minimum wage, and the minimum wage essentially is just set by politicians at a certain rate, whereas the living wage, as you said, Ciara, would be evidence-based and would track inflation, and it sets down different parameters for what a person needs to earn every hour to be able to afford the basics, the essentials. This isn't, you know, to be able to afford to go shopping in Brown Thomas and buy designer handbags. This is essentially what evidence shows and research shows a person would need to earn to be comfortable, to be able to pay their rent, not to have to cut back on so-called essentials, whether that's food or electricity and all the rest. So for last year, that was set at $12.90, so $2.40 higher than the current minimum wage.
And that was last year, Elaine?
That was last
year. Before a war in Ukraine.
Exactly. And obviously the living wage could go up and down depending on the circumstances, and that's how it also it differs from the minimum wage that, that we do have in place right now. And as I said, a lot of TDs got up in the dole, whether it was from Fine Gael, from Labour, from Solidarity PPP, all stating that this is the way we need to go. This is the move that we need to make. And even the government parties themselves have said that, yes, we will go towards a minimum or a living wage, albeit on a phased basis. The rural independents got up, and while they did make brief references to the cost of living and people being unable to afford to travel to work, the emphasis was certainly on businesses and how they might be obstructed by this if we were to move to a living wage, because obviously it would be significantly higher at the moment anyway than the minimum wage. So it kind of raises questions, I thought anyway, around the rural independents. What exactly do they stand for? Because, you know, we did have a couple of weeks ago where they were absolutely up in arms, like a lot of people in the Dáil and like a lot of people outside the Dáil, around this proposed ban on selling of turf. And it was stressed at that time that this would impact the poorest in our society who are burning solid fuels at the moment, who maybe are living in uninsulated homes, and that they rely on turf. I thought it was slightly curious that only a couple of weeks later, independent TDs would move to back up, in this instance, the business sector and raise concerns around this living wage, which would mean that businesses and employers would be paying more to their workers. And we're talking about the lowest earners here, people who are already deemed to be on the breadline in some instances, and certainly are on that minimum wage.
Now, Elaine, obviously all our TDs earn more than the average person in this country would a year. So people could argue that all TDs aren't in touch with the realities of people trying to make ends meet, right? We've always heard that argument. But as you put it here, which is it, support the poor or support the poor when it suits them in terms of the independent rurals? But in the case of our TDs, it seems as if a lot of the rural independents or the independent rurals themselves are quite wealthy and probably don't fall into that bracket most at risk in the current cost of living crisis.
Yeah, and People for Profit Solidarity TD, Paul Murphy, highlighted that there are 370,000 workers in this country who are regarded as low paid, and none of our TDs and senators in the Dáil could say that they're anywhere near that. Although Danny Healy-Ray, the Kerry TD, who curiously can claim up to, I think it's 33,395 a year in travel expenses, because he is one of the furthest from the Dáil, so can claim that rate of travel expenses if he attends the Dáil for
every
the
session,
designated number of days.
Okay.
He said that he, and I'll quote, "I know better than anyone else that people's wages do not go far enough now because of the cost of it. Everything, including the cost of travelling to work." And he said that in Kerry, people need to travel to work, as does he. Of course, in Kerry, I don't think the majority of workers would be getting those kind of travel expenses if they need to work, albeit people in Kerry might not have to travel to Dublin like Mr. Healy-Ray does. But that was the kind of contributions that we heard during that debate. Likewise, Cork Southwest TD Michael Collins said that if we were to move to this living wage, that we would risk being dragged into what he calls a wage price spiral if workers began demanding kind of higher wages. And I think he was talking both about the lower income workers, but also private sector workers. And we do know that there have been these calls, both from the private sector unions and public sector unions, around the need to increase wages now because of inflation and because of the cost of living. Now, Michael Collins did say that, in fact, it's perhaps not the workers who are the voiceless, but the small businesses that employ less than 10 people and are what he called the lifeblood of rural Ireland. And they're the type of people and businesses who are already impacted by the high cost of even doing businesses, then added to that the risk of inflation, energy prices, and he mentioned crippling levels of bureaucracy and red tape that emanate from government. If this was to be added to it, the living wage, he was claiming that that would cripple them.
If I just touch on this for our listeners here in Kildare in particular, you know, you mentioned there independent Danny Healy Ray, obviously lives down in Kerry, has to travel one of the furthest to get to the Dáil for the sessions he needs to attend and obviously to do his job as a TD. Completely understandable that it's going to cost more than somebody who's living closer. He can claim up to €33,395, as you said, Elaine. If we look at the general population of this county, Kildare, a lot will be heading, or majority will be heading to Dublin every day. Now, it may not be as long in distance, but you're sitting in traffic, you're technically, you know, using fuel in that sense. But as we know, time is one of the most precious things, and it takes people a long time to get to work due to, you know, unfortunately, the road infrastructures and the public transport infrastructure we have in this country and from this county into the capital, etc., etc. So people sometimes get very frustrated when they hear comments like that made by TDs who, I guess, advertise themselves as not just Mr. Healy Ray, but in general, I'm talking about in terms of politics, as, you know, men or women of the people. But they're not fully in touch with what's happening with everyone, if that makes sense. And I know no human can ever be fully au fait with another's, as they say, you know, walk a mile in my own shoes.
And of course, I'm sure every TD in the Dáil would say they hold constituency clinics. They're constantly talking to people in their constituency. They're, you know, getting representations into their office. So they do know what's happening. But I think it was interesting. Labour TD Sean Sherlock, I spoke to him about this, and he basically said that these group of men who did speak on the issue on that Labour bill are, and I quote, men of property presenting themselves as men of the people. And again, if you go back to the start of our conversation, the fact that they were highlighting the financial burden that would be put on people if turf was banned, now it seems to be that they were more concerned, certainly concerned about the working poor, but perhaps putting more of an emphasis on employers, small business people, and how increasing wages for those on the lowest wage would impact businesses, as opposed to how it would lift people out of poverty. And as you said, might take away that choice between putting a food on the table or cutting back on the amount of food. And we hear time and time again, it's not just, you know, people who are on social welfare at the moment, it's the working poor and the families. Sometimes parents are deciding not to have dinner so they can give their own kids a meal. And that is kind of where we're at this point, because the price even of rent is soaring, and we know that. And more and more families, working families, if they're in rented accommodation and then are evicted for various reasons, can't find further accommodation and are finding themselves in emergency accommodation, something which they never envisioned or never thought would happen to them. So we do have this increasing group of working poor that, as I said, Labour and the government do want to support and want to move to this living wage. And of course, the concerns of especially small businesses have to be listened to in this. But after listening to the debate in full, I wasn't fully sure where the independent rurals did stand on this, because as I said, they highlighted the concerns of business people, but in the end they didn't really feel strongly enough to press for a vote on the matter. So this living wage bill did go through that Dáil stage and will progress to committee stage now.
Elaine is talking about the working poor there, and the definition is working people whose incomes fall below a given poverty line due to low-income jobs and low familial household income. They're people who spend at least 27 weeks in a year working or looking for employment but remain under the poverty threshold. We're hearing more and more about the working poor as we are currently in this cost of living crisis. I do encourage people to read Elaine's article. It was published in yesterday's Irish Examiner. It can be found online, and the headline, "Who do the Healy Rays and the Rural Independents actually represent?" Elaine Loughlin is the author and she is Deputy Political Editor of the Irish Examiner. Thank you so much, Elaine.
Thanks very much.